This is The Takeaway for July 31st, 2015. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. Well, it's Friday, and we're going to wrap up the week with the political perils of campaigning in Philadelphia and ordering a cheesesteak. Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer take us to Wally World with a review of the new Vacation movie and how musicians in Sudan make music while war rages all around them. But we begin with an ongoing attack against the United States that's really come to light earlier this year in April. That's when the Federal Office of Personnel Management, OPM, discovered a breach of its data network. The OPM is basically the federal government's human resources department. They manage background checks and job applications for millions of potential federal employees. It was likely the biggest government data breach in history, with more than 21 million people compromised. The U.S. has one of the best cyber defense systems in the world, but these breaches keep going on and on. And even today, according to an NSA map obtained exclusively by NBC News, the Chinese government has hacked the U.S. more than 600 times on all sectors of the economy. That includes not only the government, but companies that hold our credit information, our social security numbers, and in some cases, our secret dating habits, potentially. So this week, U.S. intelligence officers say they're coming up with a new strategy. Listen to Director of National Intelligence James Clapper speaking to NBC News. Now listen closely.
We are in the mode of reacting to these attacks, assaults, this purloining of intellectual property, etc. And until such time, though, as we can come up with some cyber norms, which include some form of deterrence, which people recognize and respect, this will continue.
Deterrence? Was that just a slip of the tongue? Or did the Director of National Intelligence just reveal a super secret cyber program that paves the way for the U.S. to hit back?
Deterrence is the art of producing in the mind of the enemy the fear to attack.
Thank you, Peter Sellers. But let's assume that cyber deterrence doesn't look like a Dr. Strangelove doomsday device. What does it look like, and how would it prevent future attacks? Joining us is Peter Singer. He's the author of Cybersecurity and Cyber War and the new novel Ghost Fleet. He's also a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. Peter, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me on.
So a bit of Dr. Strangelove there, obviously the conceit. A doomsday device in the old world is a giant nuclear bomb or a bunch of them on submarines or somewhere else. I get that. What does a doomsday deterrent in cyberspace look like? And how do you tell other countries that you have it?
Well, I think that's part of the problem is that we're looking for, I would argue, the wrong lessons from the Cold War. So, you know, in many ways, if there is a parallel to the Cold War, it's that early period where we actually took the real world versions of Dr. Strangelove seriously rather than laughing at him right now. So, you know, essentially we need to distinguish between someone trying to steal your secrets versus someone trying to carry out, you know, an actual act of cyber war, an actual, you know, as they jokingly call it, cyber Pearl Harbor, 9/11, whatever, where you're actually causing physical damage, people dying and the like. And so when it comes to secrets, that's unfortunately part of the game. The back and forth, you're not going to, you know, be able to prevent any kind of, you know, this espionage from ever ending 100%. So you're not looking here for some kind of overwhelming response. You're looking for both what they call deterrence by denial, where it's keeping the other person from accomplishing their goals. That's why they don't attack you. And in cybersecurity, whether the attacker is espionage, whether the attacker is crime, whatnot, what you're really looking for is not so much deterrence, but resilience, the ability to just power through it, to shake it off. So in many ways, you know, the lessons we should be taking here are not from Dr. Strangelove, but jokingly, in many ways, from Taylor Swift.
I assume you mean shake it off.
Yes, and the idea of what I'm saying here, in, you know, half joke but in serious, is the magic word in cybersecurity is resilience. It's how do I power through the attack? How do I make the attack not matter? So the example would be with the OPM. They get inside my systems, but so what? They don't actually get easy access to records of 21 million Americans. Or the example with Sony would be, yes, they get inside, but you aren't knocked offline completely. You aren't like a turtle on your back. And so, again, there's lessons here. If we're going back to the Cold War, it's not mutual assured destruction, because you're not going to get it in cybersecurity with the U.S. We are the most vulnerable.
I've noticed that one of the reactions to these repeated attacks, as bad as they are, is to say, well, we believe the Chinese are behind it. We believe Russia's behind it. And our mind goes to state actors, the Chinese government or Vladimir Putin running a shop that's fomenting these attacks. In reality, it could be criminal gangs, like you said. The variety of different groups, governmental, non-governmental, or quasi-governmental, that could be doing this seems so broad that knowing who to attack and how becomes inordinately complex.
Indeed. And that's why if you're looking for Cold War parallels, the parallels that you're looking for are trying to establish the norms of who can play, who can't, and what are the kind of actions that I may not like you doing them to me, but they're at least acceptable in some manner. So if you go back to during the Cold War, the CIA and the KGB competed really hard. They certainly didn't like that each other was stealing secrets, but they also created certain kind of rules of the game in terms of, you know, we can't go around killing each other's agents all the time. We have to be able to keep this espionage game from escalating into something dangerous. And that's the same kind of norms that we're going to need to be able to build with, say, a China, which is, you know, look, we don't like you stealing our secrets, but there's other things that neither side should do because it will endanger us in getting into an actual war.
Before we let you go, Peter Singer, what concrete steps can we take? You know, if Russia and China, I use sort of the capital R and the capital C there, have decided that their strategy is to keep things from getting to the line of real confrontation. It's annoying. It's illegal. We don't like it. We complain about it, but it's nothing that's going to provoke stealth bombers over their territory, and they know that. How do we change where the line is to change their incentives for attacking us? You've already said we can make it harder so that you're not going to necessarily get as much of what you want if you break into Sony servers. But what else can we do to really make them feel like it's not worth their time?
So there's three levels here. The first, as you hit it, is resilience. Make it harder for them so that they aren't incentivized to go after you. The second is to try and create some costs for them in other realms. So, for example, there is an upcoming approval needed by the U.S. government for a Chinese purchase of a major American software company. We may want to communicate, hey, you were going to gain this value. You're not going to be because of both the risk to us of you having control of this system, and then also this is what comes when you steal our secrets. And the third is to try and create norms on an international level so that this is not just a U.S.-China or a U.S.-Russia game. It's about the broader global economy where we start creating norms that, hey, if you want to be a player in the international economy, you can't be out there simultaneously using your state government and state-linked groups to steal secrets.
Peter Singer is the author of Cybersecurity and Cyber War. He's got a new novel. It's called Ghost Fleet. Peter Singer, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Officials with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service have spoken with representatives for Dr. Walter Palmer. He's the dentist from Minnesota who killed the most famous lion in Zimbabwe for sport. They say he is cooperating and that the investigation is ongoing. And now Zimbabwe has started extradition proceedings to try Palmer for financing an illegal hunt. The White House said it will review a petition for extradition. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said it's up to the Justice Department to respond to the extradition request. Josh Collins is a reporter for Minnesota Public Radio News.
I mean, there's been the same sort of outrage here that we've seen internationally and especially online. But the advantage is here the protests have focused on his dental practice, which is in Bloomington. That's a suburb of Minneapolis. And we have both animal rights advocates and people who hunt recreationally both coming together for once to oppose this trophy hunting. Both of them say that it's dishonorable.
And no one has heard from Walter Palmer for a number of days, right?
That's right. We have not received any official word from him, any official comments since Wednesday when he released a statement saying essentially that he's sorry that he took this particular lion and he was not aware that it was as popular as it was or that it was a research topic.
Now, that hasn't been good enough for the government of Zimbabwe. The authorities there say they want him extradited. They want to try him under their laws. Is there a risk that he would be arrested by the Fish and Wildlife authorities or the FBI and extradited to Zimbabwe? Is that a possibility?
Well, an attorney I spoke to says it is a possibility that he may be extradited because there is a treaty between Zimbabwe and the United States, but it is a less than automatic process. It takes quite a while, and especially if you can afford lawyers, it can be drawn out for a very long time. So there are quite a few steps before he ends up in Zimbabwe, if that is the process that we go through.
And does anybody have any inkling of where he could be?
You know, we've talked to him multiple times from the newsroom by contacting him through phone. He picks up the phone. He's not very forthcoming after that point, but he has been picking up the phone. So all we can really say at this point is he's somewhere where there is cell phone service.
One of the questions, John Collins, that hasn't been answered is, where is Cecil's body now? Zimbabwe authorities were upset that Walter Palmer, they said, absconded before they could apprehend him. Did he take the body of Cecil the Lion with him back to the United States?
It appears he did not. What we've heard is that officials in Zimbabwe have claimed the body, and so they're going through whatever sort of process their wildlife management goes through with that.
And meanwhile, it looks like back there in Minnesota, the dental practice of Walter Palmer isn't going to be opening its doors and doing cleanings anytime soon.
It doesn't look like it. And the practice has been closed since this news broke. But the protests have cleared out from there. But at the same time, it doesn't look like they'll be opening anytime soon.
John Collins, reporter with Minnesota Public Radio News, with an update on Dr. Walter Palmer in Minnesota. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
John Kasich is doing his thing in New Hampshire today. Chris Christie is campaigning in Iowa, along with several other candidates. Rand Paul and Scott Walker earlier this week visited my home state of Pennsylvania. But for this story, we have to go to one very specific corner of PA.
Howard's from Philly, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay, go with a cheesesteak.
Yeah.
But prep him on how to order it. No Swiss, no Munster. He gets it with sauce and whiz.
Whiz?
Cheese whiz. Ask Howard.
Many have tried, and very few have succeeded, apparently. Governor Scott Walker joins the latest in a long line of political figures who failed to properly order a Philly cheesesteak at two of Philly's most iconic sandwich shops. Now, Walker is charged with ordering American cheese on his Philly cheesesteak instead of the more traditional cheese whiz. And it was a mistake that's viewed by many in the Philadelphia populace as a potential deal breaker for their support. But not everyone.
Scott Walker did absolutely nothing wrong.
That is my friend Jeffrey Young. He's a reporter at the Huffington Post, and more importantly right now, a very opinionated Philly native.
Well, it's true that, you know, sometimes these little mini gaffes can have an impact on a campaign. They make a candidate look out of touch or make it look like they don't care that much or know that much about the place where they're trying to convince voters that they absolutely love. But in this case, ordering American cheese and no onions on a cheesesteak is a perfectly legitimate order. And I say this as somebody who's never had onions on my cheesesteak because I think onions are disgusting. Now, having said all of that, I still think it was bogus when John Kerry tried to order Swiss cheese on his cheesesteak when he was running for president.
Well, for real answers, there's only one man to go to. He's Dan Pashman. He's host and creator of WNYC's podcast, The Sporkful. And he says politicians should forget the pantomime of regional authenticity in political campaigns and go for a novel concept. Order what they like.
Well, I think with any regional food, the region that creates the food has a right to lay out the boundaries of what defines that food, what is or is not a Philly cheesesteak. And if you look at the menus of all the top most famous cheesesteak places in Philly, they offer three cheese options: Cheese Whiz, American, and Provolone. Now, it's true that Cheese Whiz is considered by many to be the sort of quote-unquote most authentic. But to me, as long as all these places offer American and provolone as options, American's okay.
And without onions.
They make a big deal out of this sticky thing in Philly where you say wit if you want onions, as in with onions.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have a term for it if it was not a valid choice.
Indeed.
They would just put the onions on and you would have to say, oh, please hold the onions. So there is a choice to be made there, which means that either choice is acceptable within the canon. This is where I think that a region's authority ends in terms of dictating these sorts of terms. Philly can say Swiss is not an acceptable cheese to put on a Philly cheesesteak, but they can't say that Swiss cheese on a steak sandwich is not delicious. A Philly cheesesteak with Swiss cheese would probably taste really good.
And it raises another key point as somebody who's from Pennsylvania, by the way. I'm not from Philly, but close by, and I know my share of politics. I always wonder about these gaffe stories, because if I'm in Philly and Scott Walker from Wisconsin comes and orders a cheesesteak wrong, I say, yeah, because he's not from Philly. He's not from here.
Right.
Why would he get it right? But it's this need to have a transmitted sense of authenticity, even from people who aren't from our town. We need to think that they get us. I'm making scare quotes there. What is that?
Authenticity is a huge barometer by which people judge political candidates. And there's this sort of bizarre dance that goes on where politicians have to perfect the art of pretending to be authentic.
And food is a huge part of that for a lot of people.
Absolutely, because it's a regional thing, and different regions take pride in the dishes that they're famous for, and they want to see that you're sort of showing them that you're a quote-unquote real person. But the truth is that, like, if you're just being truly authentic and true to yourself and the person that you are, you might just not like onions. Which is more authentic? To pretend to want it the exact way that people in Philly say you're supposed to want it, or to actually want it the way you actually want it?
There's a sort of self-fulfilling panderism involved in this, because when you enforce a draconian code of authenticity, you get what you ask for. And when it comes to food, something that people take really, really personally, and they're going to laugh and point at you if you do it wrong, you're going to get exactly what you ask for.
Totally. And it always drives me crazy when a politician gets out of office or loses an election. I remember this happened with Al Gore after he lost, and he started giving these impassioned fire and brimstone speeches. Same things happened more recently with Mitt Romney. And people, you know, these guys who were labeled as stiff in the campaign, then they're not campaigning, and the sort of chatter in classes all say, where was this guy during the campaign? And it's like, you beat this guy into submission by forcing him to order the cheesesteak that you thought he should order instead of letting him order the cheesesteak he wanted.
Now, back during the last campaign, you know, it brings to mind a quote that was attributed to Mitt Romney, not really a gaffe, but kind of a campaign moment. People made fun of him. He tasted some lemonade at the fair or wherever he was, and his response was, lemon, wet, good. It seems very honest to me.
Right.
Accurate as can be. Dan, you've been talking to some people who kind of give a rundown from the ground about what it means to order a cheesesteak in Philly.
Yeah, that's right. We did a Sporkful podcast episode a couple months ago called This Is Your Brain on Cheesesteak. I ran around the city, got a bunch of Philly food, and took it to a sensory scientist to learn, like, why does cheesesteak taste so good to us? And I interviewed one African-American guy at a cheesesteak shop, Sonny's, which was delicious. And this is what he told me about cheese preferences in the city.
As an African-American male living in Philadelphia, I have to say American cheese is the way to go. Essentially, I believe that the white man has a predisposition towards cheese whiz. The African-American male, some reason, we can only eat American cheese, man.
So you think that Philly cheesesteak preferences break down along racial lines?
It gets that serious.
So, Dan Pashman, here's the key question now. What should Scott Walker do for his campaign to recover from this horrible, horrendous, presidential aspiration-killing gaffe? It seems to me he needs to come out of this terrible moment for his campaign and declare, hey, I was honest, I like it the way I like it, I'm not going to pander to people in Philly, and the people of Philadelphia will understand when I don't try to be one of them and order it some way because they want me to. I'm a real candidate.
I think that would be a great approach. I think the best way for him to do that is to embrace his Wisconsin roots. What I would do if I were him is I would get some cheese curds from Wisconsin, and I would show up at a Philly cheesesteak place, and I would say, I want one cheesesteak, hold the cheese, which is like the most ridiculous thing you could say at a Philly cheesesteak joint. Then take the steak sandwich and add his own cheese from Wisconsin to say, look, I'm proud of where I'm from. I love the cheese in my home state.
And this is how we do.
And this is how we do it. You know, and now that sandwich doesn't exist in Wisconsin. But like, the point is that would be showing real local pride.
It does exist. And you know what it's called?
What?
It's called the Walker. That's Dan Pashman, who's the host of The Sporkful on WNYC. You can subscribe to The Sporkful podcast on iTunes. Good news for China today. The International Olympic Committee voted 44-40, a close one, to give Beijing the hosting rights to the 2022 Winter Olympics. It was a small margin for a win over Almaty in Kazakhstan. and the win makes Beijing the first city in history to host both the summer and winter games. Now, winters in Beijing can be cold, but they're also pretty dry, not a lot of snow. But when the games come around, the Weather Modification Office is probably going to have to seed clouds with chemicals to induce a lot of precipitation up in the mountains. Even the ski resorts 150 miles away may have to rely on fake snow. Hui Fernte is a reporter for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation based in Beijing. Fern, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
So tell us what a Beijing winter is like. Is it lots of snow and people frolicking on ice ponds, ice skating? Is it a winter wonderland?
Beijing used to be a winter wonderland. The locals here say that, years ago, every winter, Beijing would see lots of snow in the city. You wouldn't have to go too far, you know. But then, you know, I've been here for, 4.5 years now, and I've rarely seen much snow in the city. It does get pretty cold, though, and so people go ice skating on the lake and that sort of stuff. But if you want to go skiing, alpine skiing, then you have to drive, I think, about 4 hours or so to get to this other ski resort that will be hosting the snow events during the Winter Olympics in 2022.
Now, what kind of natural snow are the mountain venues getting? Or are they going to have to spend a lot of time and money manufacturing it for downhill and slalom and everything else?
The ski resorts in Zhangjiakou, which is in Hebei province, about 170 kilometers away from Beijing, they do get natural snow, but also they have to spend quite a fair bit of money topping it up with man-made snow. And the concern last year was that this would put some stress on the water levels over there, because here in northern China, the water is a problem. But then the very senior representative from Beijing's Winter Olympics Committee said, you know, that won't be an issue at all, because the amount of water needed to create all this man-made snow will only take up a very, very small proportion of the water supply there.
Now, people around Beijing, of course, have been through a very recent Olympics already, Summer Olympics. They've signed up for a new one, or at least their leaders have. Are they saying that they're ready to cough up the money and the disruption and the traffic delays to construct new venues for hockey and speed skating and all the things that are going to come along with a new Olympics in the city?
Well, Beijing is a very proud to be the first city to host both the Summer and Winter Olympics. Beijing won the bid based on its promise to reuse most of the facilities that it built for the 2008 Summer Olympics. So, for example, the Bird's Nest Stadium, the beautiful Bird's Nest Stadium, will be used for the opening ceremony of the Winter Olympics in 2022. And the Water Cube, which had the swimming events in 2008, will be used for curling. And so Kazakhstan also put in a similar sort of proposal to be economical, to keep it cheap, relatively cheap, that is. But still, you know, the IOC decided to go with Beijing.
Still, there aren't a lot of hockey arenas around the city, I take it. I know there's some figure skating.
Yeah, there is some figure skating, and winter sports generally isn't a huge thing over here. I mean, people do go ice skating on the frozen lake in winter and all that, but it's not huge, you know, not in the same way that it is in, say, Canada or Europe.
Well, it's not huge now, but maybe Chinese authorities are betting on a new birth of winter sports in Beijing. That's because Beijing has landed the Winter Games for 2022, despite the fact that it just doesn't snow that much in Beijing anymore. Hui Fernte, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for your time.
Hui Fernte is a reporter for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation based in Beijing. On the border between Sudan and South Sudan, the citizens of the Blue Nile and Nuba Mountains live with the sound of warfare, gunfire between Sudanese forces and rebels who would prefer to be part of South Sudan. But once that dust settles, the people of Blue Nile and the Nuba Mountains make a very different sound. Fighting the sounds of war with the sounds of music. That's the premise of a new documentary called Beats of the Antonov. Ajuj Kuka is the creator of the film, and he says that before you can understand the music, you have to understand the complexity of Sudan's cultural history.
In 2011, the country split, and that's what most people know. And then a lot of people think that that was the end of it, and that was the end of the conflict, and now everything is good. But what happened was there's people who are in Blue Nile and Nuba Mountains who were fighting alongside the South. And when the split happened, because the split happened along the lines that were drawn by the British before independence, the people from Nuba Mountains and Blue Nile were not considered part of South Sudan. They were considered part of North Sudan. So when the split happened, they were just remained part of North Sudan. And then what the government tried to do was to disarm them. And in the process of disarming them, they started this new conflict, new civil war. And that's the civil war we have right now that started in 2011. And that's what the film is about. It's actually the war that's happening in North Sudan after the split.
And a big part of that war and that conflict, it is a war of independence or a continued civil war, but a big part of the backdrop is sort of the cultural and religious identity between the people who live in the Blue Nile region that you spent time with and the government in Khartoum. And it's really a conflict in many ways between sort of an Arab Muslim culture in the north and a more African identity in the south. And the music that you talk about so much really sort of comes out in that conflict. And I'd like to hear you talk about that a little bit and what it means to the people in your film.
Yeah, so it's actually it's more complicated than a simple African-Arab conflict. There's like 57 different ethnic groups in Sudan. And the best way to show it is actually to look at the music and the dance, because then you start knowing what these people really are. And then it's very easy to realize how African this is and how rooted it is, and to actually start to understand the complexity of identity.
And your film really revolves around the music at the center of the lives of the people in Blue Nile. You spoke to one woman, a Sudanese refugee named Insaf Awad. Let's hear from her now.
Culture protects us. If people don't release their pain, they will become miserable without these parties to lift their spirits. When people are anxious and disturbed, dancing helps them get over it.
And that's an analysis that is, she was looking around her and analyzing it. A lot of people are just doing it. They're just using music to just be happy and enjoy the moment. I mean, when I was inspired to make the film, it is when I heard this music and I saw how happy people are and actually participated in these parties. And I just noticed that there's another side to the story. It's not just a single story of these victims and they're having a hard time. It's just a story of humans and how they can, in the worst of conditions, find the best in life and smile and be able to actually look towards the future.
You also feature an instrument that I'd never heard of before called the rababa. And here's Sudanese musician Joda Bujud. He's a rababa player. Let's listen to him talk about this instrument a little bit.
When you play the rababa, people forget their hardships for a moment. They enter a state of happiness. When you see me play, don't you feel happy? You join the dance like everyone else.
So, Hajuj, I had never seen a rababa before I watched your film. Describe what it is and sort of the place it has in the music that the people in Blue Nile enjoy all the time.
So the rababa is a very traditional instrument that's found throughout East Africa all the way up to Egypt. And it's this string instrument. And the beauty about the one we listen to in the refugee camp that Joda plays is actually he recreated it from plates and found objects. And the strings were from this motorcycle brakes. And then he used this old radio that vibrates a certain way. And then when he sings into it, the sound is a little distorted. So it has this electronic new feel to it. I love that. And it's on the rababa that's made out of metal now. The traditional one is made out of wood, but because they had to run away without taking the instruments, then, I mean, you have to pick up kids and you have to pick up food, so the last thing you can pick up is an instrument. So they had to recreate it. And then now you have this, it's an amazing new electronic sounding, fresh sound.
I loved it too, and at the same time, it draws me right back to the terrible part of your film, Hajuj, because you have a music documentary, a dance documentary that has combat footage. The people in your film jump in trucks, armed personnel carriers. They go right off to war. You're there with them as the guns crack and the Kalashnikovs go off and the bombs from the Antonovs rain down on them. It's a little hard to take.
Yeah. And actually getting bombed at the first time and just the whole vibration and the sound and the bombing is just an experience that is that makes you think a lot about humanity and why is this happening and why are we killing each other, especially we're all Sudanese. And like, a civil war is the worst kind of war, and it's a real war and people are dying. So to me, it was very important to show that, just to show that, okay, it's not all people are dancing. This is the most horrific situation you can be in. But then it was the whole idea that we need to end this war. There has to be a solution so people can stop dying. And I think that's why from then on, I went into the deeper, like, why are we killing each other, and trying to find the core reasons for this so we can hopefully, as Sudanese and as everybody else who cares about people in that area, can find solutions.
And as a Sudanese person, Hajuj, do you see a way out here? I mean, so much of your film details the difficulty of cultural hegemony between the Blue Nile region and Khartoum. Is there a way out here?
It is complicated. Being there, I found that there is a solution. And I think in the film, I have it where there was a scene where people come together to solve an issue. And once people come out and say, okay, I'm wrong, and this is the problem, and apologize, then people can sit down and find a solution. And I think as Sudanese people, we can find a solution. And I'm hoping that the solution we find can be used by humanity to try to solve this global issue of identity and global issue of how do we live together and actually celebrate our identity instead of actually fighting along it. So to me, I dream of a Sudan that celebrates its diversity. It's like we have a national identity that considers the 57 different ethnic groups.
Hajuj Kuka is a filmmaker. He's the creator of Beats of the Antonov, a new documentary following the people of the Blue Nile region, their culture and their music in the face of civil war in Sudan. Hajuj, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Beats of the Antonov premieres on PBS on August 3rd. And here's something to take with you today. If you go outside tonight, you'll see a blue moon, the first since 2012. It's been a few years. But don't expect a different color from the moon. A blue moon is really just the second full moon of the month. But you know, the thing is, they only come around once in a while. That's all for today. If you want to respond to anything you've heard on today's program, including bad jokes, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can ask me anything on Twitter. You can also comment and complain or compliment me if you like. You can find me there at Todd Zwillick. And take The Takeaway with you. Subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. It's a great way to stay up on the news. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. John is back next week, so have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.